I'd like to talk about artistic practice in particular as a form of research. And this is part of oops. So this is part of a series of talks that I'm hoping to give in the Research Conversation series that is really centered around my experiences in a large EU-funded project at Plymouth University called Cognovo, which was it was a doctoral training program that funded 25 PhDs to do interdisciplinary research on the theme of creativity and cognition. And it involved people from the arts, the humanities, sciences, and technology research. And over across the next three talks, I'd like to kind of pick out experiences and that I've had in Cognovo and unpack them and hopefully argue that we need something like this at the university, at UPOU, at UP, in the Philippines, anywhere, it doesn't matter, but we need a bit something more like this. Just a question about sorry, a response to the question about paradigms. Sino nagtanong nun? Right. One of the things in Cognovo that we had done, and this is just a short aside, but one of the things we had done was because there were so many subjects that were covered, we ended up, and I'll talk about this slide a little bit more, we ended up doing 5-week-long workshops spaced over 1.5 years in the arts, in experimental psychology, in computational modeling, in all of these things. And I thought it was very successful, but it's worth pointing out that it takes a while for these insights to sink in. And I think that really the benefits of this interdisciplinary training program we will see in about 5 to 10 years, not right now, although we've had some really interesting outcomes since then. And again, just to kind of riff off Dr. Passy's typology of interdisciplinary practices, we had all four types of interdisciplinary-ness, interdisciplinarity. In Cognovo, we had the computational neurosciences, psychology, humanities, media art, dance and performance. But it was interesting, though, was that in a program that was about creativity and cognition, we had psychologists, but we had no anthropologists. We had no political scientists. We didn't have anyone who looked at creativity and cognition from a social perspective. It is very interesting, and I think it's partly because of the, who got together and formed the grant, who were the strong departments at Plymouth University at the time. We had methodological diversity, so everything that Dr. Passy had put down in his slide, we had and argued about endlessly. If not in a formal lecture setting, then in pubs, we did. And we did have a diverse context, a number of contexts that we had to serve and keep in mind. So we had universities with I do know that it's plural. So we worked, so Plymouth University was the center of the training program, but we worked with a bunch of universities across the UK, across Europe, across the world. And this is something that I wish we can see a bit more in the Philippines. We worked with research institutions that were not universities. And we worked with industries. So as I had talked about in my previous talk at Research Conversations, I was seconded at a design company in London for 8 months where I could prototype my work and see where that went. But interestingly, even though we were funded by the European Commission, none of us were seconded to a government unit. To so I'm not sure exactly what's going on with that. I can sense that Dr. Passy has a response to that. In terms of cultural interdisciplinarity, we came from everywhere. In fact, the EU funded students that were specifically not from the UK. I said that we had some English and Scottish students in the UK. They were not actually funded by the EU directly. Only those that were from Turkey, France, Austria, the Philippines, Germany, India, we got the full Marie Curie funding, as it is called. I think two talks down the line, I'll also be talking about a book chapter that has been accepted for publication. It should be coming out soon in a book that will be published by the same people who produced the IRRODL, IJR, yeah. So, and it's about this idea of openness and how this relates to interdisciplinarity. And we propose this idea of multi-perspective, interperspective, and trans-perspective openness. We'll see how well we actually defend that when the book chapter comes out. But, okay, so this is really what I wanted to talk about. My talk was motivated by a distinction that we make at the university about whether the work you do is research or creative. And and there's always a distinction made, even up till recently in the BAMS program, students were asked to either do a creative project or a research project. And I'd like to challenge that, that actually all creative projects are research projects, in the sense that all creative projects and are still based on some kind of question. When you're making a work of dance, you may be asking yourself, how do I engage the audience's physicality in my work? How do I, how do I instill a sense of danger, for example? A really good example of a dance company that does this is a group in Europe called Ultima Vez. And what they do is they throw these concrete blocks across the stage while dancing. And all the time as an audience member, you're kind of seated, you're at the edge of your seat, wondering, whose head is going to get smashed first, whether you're going to see blood right away. And, you come out of this feeling exhilarated. And if this had been a research project, and if the question was, how do I get the audience to be physically engaged while watching a dance, I think they answered the question very well. And they answered the question through the work that they produced. Just a brief overview. So I had talked about this in the past, so I'm not going to dwell on it too much. So my work at my PhD research was in designing vibrating clothing for body awareness, and it was inspired by costume design. This was, again, I had talked about this in a previous talk. This was the prototype that I had developed. You can control it with a mobile phone. You can install it in furniture. We've implemented it as part of a high fashion, haute couture fashion. And we've demonstrated that that the prototype can measurably change your awareness of your body. And you can probably actually do some quantitative measuring of the output that we've had. But anyway, so what I really wanted to talk about is what does practice as research means, or practice as research. And it's research where creative or artistic practice is central to the research. And a distinction is often made between practice-led and practice-based research. So practice-led research leads to a new understanding about the practice. So if you are doing research in painting and you do research about painters, you interview them, you study the history of painting, and then you come up with a theory about how painters think, how they create, how they see the world. That's practice-led. Practice-based is when your research includes a creative artifact as a contribution to knowledge, or when the research involves engaging in the practice. So in your research about painters painting, you could interview painters, you could study art history, but you could paint yourself. And in the process of painting, you learn something about the artistic, the creative process, and you use that knowledge in when you report your results. And when you report the results, not only do you talk about the things that you've discovered and learned, you present the paintings that you've done as a testament to what it is that you've actually learned. So in a practice-led research, what counts as an answer to a research question? The answer to a research question, because all research is based ultimately on a question, The answer to the research question is often an idea that you can write about and you can read about it. But in a practice-based research, the answer to the question includes a thing. It could be a design, a piece of music, digital media, a performance, an exhibition. The answer to a practice-based research question is a thing that you experience, not just read. So how do you, so as I said, when you do a practice-led research, you observe the practice, the creative process. In a practice-based research, you often do the practice. You have to read the results of a practice-led research work. And a practice-based piece of research needs to be experienced as well. So for example, when I defended my PhD, I had my examiners wear my wearable technology, and I guided them through a 15-minute process, because the knowledge, the contribution to knowledge, isn't just what I talk about. It's that experience that you go through, which I hope you will experience when you come to the Asinale exhibit next week. So here are some examples of results or statements that come out of a practice-led research. The idea that algorithms can be used to create interesting, unpredictable, useful designs. You can leverage the properties of the human perceptual system, yada yada. But to create things that exemplify these ideas, those are practice-based approaches. So for instance, is anyone familiar with this antenna? Do you know what this is? Right. Do you know what a genetic algorithm is? A genetic algorithm is a process that where you allow the computer to evolve optimal solutions to a problem, and you don't really know how it's going to come out in the end. This is an example of one of the first pieces it's a product that was created by a genetic algorithm. This is an antenna that was used for a space mission. Or for something that they did in space. And the antenna had to be optimized to account for all these technical things. And they didn't know how to design this precisely. There were too many variables to control for. So what they did was they modeled this as an algorithm, and they let the algorithm decide what the most optimal design was. And it came up with this. No human could have really come up with this design. I think this image is too small, but that's an image of George Seurat's image of painting. I think it's called Sunday in the Park. And if you see it in real life, the painting is made out of tiny, tiny dots that are spread all over. And what happened was, when George Seurat had painted this, new information about the human perceptual system was just coming to light. They found out that the human eye had these three cells, three types of cells that detect color. And so he used that knowledge to create a new type of painting, pointillism, which combined. Well, it's not that new. I mean, people have been practicing for ages, but you know, he had formalized it for the first time and exhibited it very publicly. There's a series of works down here, which this is the Biomod series, which King was also part of, and we explored how you can create very different, how you can combine very different types of system to create surprising mutually beneficial relationships. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Right. So the other thing I wanted to for us to think about is the relationship between arts and science. And there's a few ways in which they can be those two fields interact with each other in a research setting. Art can be used as a methodology to uncover or create new knowledge in another discipline. So for example, when I created my wearable technology, a psychologist had come across it during a public exhibition, and she wondered whether this could change the way people feel about food cravings, whether this could affect people's food cravings, because she has this whole theory about how it is that we crave food. And so we conducted a controlled experiment with 60 people, and turns out vibration can distract you from your food cravings, and it can, in the lab, reduce your chocolate cravings, at least. So this is an example. So my work, though, was created as, I mean, not that chocolate craving is something you would ever want to get rid of, but it's an example of how I engaged in an artistic process to create basically a very interesting wearable sensation. Well, sorry, a very interesting sensation. And then it was used for scientific research. There's a lot of evidence suggests that vibrotactile stimuli can be used as a sleep aid, for stroke rehabilitation, for chronic pain, for mindfulness. And so, again, the artistic work that I created could be used for something else that I didn't plan for at all. This came kind of after the fact. Moving away from what I do, there are artists out there who take scientific data and then they visualize it or sonify it, meaning they take the data and they transform it into a different modality. So in this case, an artist has taken data from solar flares collected by satellites, and he created sounds that corresponded to the activity of the solar flares. And then as a result, they were able to hear patterns in the sounds that they were not able to pick up through observing the data or through analyzing it mathematically. And they were able to make a discovery out of that. And they've done this, I think, for earthquakes as well. And this is based on the idea that the human ear has evolved over millions of years and it can pick up really subtle patterns. So here, in this art for science kind of collaboration or intersection, you're taking properties of the human perceptual system and leveraging that as a way to create new knowledge. This was the work of an artist that I came across. Jennifer Nikolova's sister experienced a psychotic attack in 2004, and then 3 years later, she died. And ever since then, she's been interested in trying to get people to understand what it is like to have a psychotic attack. So she created this virtual reality experience where you could experience a psychosis. And I never got to wear it myself, but I've been told that it is one of the most compelling things you can ever experience. For example, so you'd put it on, and then voices would start talking to you. And then the experimenter would be there and would offer you a glass of water and go like, you know, so are you okay? Would you like a glass of water? And she gives you the glass of water, and then the voice in that you hear over the virtual reality headset will tell you to not drink the water. It's poisoned. And apparently it is so compelling and so convincing that it simulates up to 24 out of 27 points of psychosis. Apparently there's a rating scale that measures kind of, or that indicates different kinds of psychotic experiences. And now it is being used, its use is being explored in clinical settings as well. And it can potentially help people who care for people with psychosis to understand them better and to empathize with their experiences. And it's important to note that Jennifer started off as an artist and continues to identify as an artist. So those are all examples of, you know, creating a work of art that has then led to new findings in another field. But I want to talk about a slightly different approach, which is how the artistic process can actually influence and change the methodology in another field. There is a politically inappropriately named problem called the fat man problem. Do you know what this is? Have you heard of this? Maybe I've talked about it. So it's a dilemma. So say you're standing on a footbridge like this, and there's a train that's speeding, and there are five people that are maybe they're tied to the train tracks, so they can't move. And right beside you is a fat man. And if you push the fat man, it's always a man, by the way, and if you push a fat man over the bridge, it will stop the train, it will save five people. If you don't do anything, then five people will kill. You know, what do you do? And for the longest time, experimental philosophers, because there is such a thing, as experimental philosophers, and psychologists have tried to understand how people would react to them, and often they would do it in kind of pen and paper, using pen and paper responses, and then they realized that, well, you know, what you say on pen and paper may not be what you do, so then they started to use virtual reality simulations to try to see what people would end up doing. But in this case, my colleagues at Cognovo decided they would go one step further, and they would try to, not only will they have a virtual reality experience to test the scenario, they would create a model with a silicone body that the person can actually push, so that when they want to push someone, they actually have a warm body that they physically push. And the question was, how does this change people's responses to the situation? They even, just as a side note, this is an electric blanket coil. So they put these electric blanket coils underneath the silicone to make it warm, to make it more realistic. But what's interesting about this isn't so much the results that they came up with, which I actually don't know what the results were, but in the process of making the sculpture, they were working with the materials, and they were realizing that there were certain questions that were appropriate to be asked in an experimental setting because of the kinds of materials that they had, because of the shape that was available, because of the limitations of the thing, of the model that they were making. John Seely Brown calls this process thinkering, thinking through making. And as you're making this thing, they're realizing, do you know what? I'm realizing that maybe I could ask this question instead. Or maybe we can't actually test the scenario because there's no head, and actually that would affect. So in the process of making the tools, the instruments for your research, you begin to really understand what kinds of questions are appropriate for that research. And that is largely a very creative process. Now, that's not exclusive to artists, but it is something that artists constantly do. Trying to see what the materials tell them is possible. A kind of a reverse relationship between science and art is the question about how scientific methods can advance artistic practice, or how science can advance art. And we've seen this multiple times throughout history. Aluminium optical art, do you know those, op art. These are examples, I'm trying to think of examples, just art that it's very dizzying to see. They often involve like closely spaced black and white lines. Or, a lot of optical art came out as a result of the interest in the way that people perceive optical illusions. And so you have a whole class of art, kinetic art, that's all about trying to trick or engage the human senses. And in my case, I work with a sculptor and a composer and a computational neuroscientist, and we took the Haplus technology that I had created, and we integrated this into an installation, and this is kind of what the installation will look like. So it's a chair that you can sit in, and then in the chair you can have a mobile phone that you're using, and you can tell the system how you want your body to feel. Sorry, I'm not explaining this very well, but I'll kind of give you an idea of how it works. So in the chair, you'd be wearing a pair of headphones, which kind of insulates you from the world. And then we selectively vibrate your body in certain parts. And the parts of your body that are vibrated will feel very different to you afterwards. And so we're using this as a tool to both as a creative tool, but also as a therapeutic tool. Using this tool, we think that we can make you feel more whole. We can integrate parts of yourself that you feel are very disconnected. But at the same time, we can push this technology further, and you can create an imaginative reimagining of yourself. So if you want to have, if you want to feel like your leg is 3 feet longer than the other leg, we might be able to do that. So this is something that we're going to be building in San Francisco this year, because the EU was interested enough to award with more funding for further development at a technology laboratory in San Francisco. And what we're going to be doing is we're going to present this as an artistic installation, but this will also be a research tool so we can gather more data about how we can better improve the interface to our technology. I guess the other thing I wanted to share with you is an initiative that King is also involved with, and Bobby Figueroa, who is doing his PhD in Japan right now. So King and I are part of we're part of an international nonprofit called Space Ecologies Art and Design, and we've been working with communities over the past 10 years to help them prototype the future through critical thinking and hands-on experimentation. And the very first example of what we had done was this biomod project, which, for those of you who don't know, this was a 10-foot-high installation that we had built over the course of 7 or 8 months. This is made out of recycled coconut wood. Inside the wood are old computers that we had refurbished and we had made to run again. The computers are being cooled with liquid living algae. The algae becomes too hot, so we cool it inside the system using a series of fish tanks and hydroponic plants. The heat from the computers creates a greenhouse effect, which nourishes the plants. The computers are running a multiplayer game that was inspired by Mount Makiling. The more you game, the hotter the computers get, the more the plants will flourish. And the game tweets. And so the idea is that the waste heat from the computers is used by living systems, and then and so there's this kind of mutually beneficial relationship between the two. And so this was just an example of how we used an artistic work, a creative process, to get people to rethink what it means to have technology and natural ecosystems working together well. These were some of the original BAM students from back in 2008, 2009. And these were kind of examples of, these were small prototypes of what would eventually become this. We've run about 20 different biomod projects around the world by now, including 10 very major ones. What was the last one I was involved in? The last one I was involved in was in Mechelen in Belgium, where we made a version of this inside a tower, an ancient 500-year-old tower with no elevators, and we had to haul this thing up about 160 steps. That was a workout. This is something I always think about when I talk about interdisciplinary research. It's this idea of yes and. So in improv, when you're trying to make an improv sketch, you're always asked to never shut down anyone's ideas. So you're on stage and you're improvising with people and someone says, oh, I have a chicken in my hand. You never say, no, you don't have a chicken in your hand. You say, yes, you have a chicken in your hand. And I have a frying pan to fry the chicken with. But you always build, and you always build, and you always build. And there's always a time for editing later. So in an interdisciplinary work, I often find it's useful to have a yes and attitude to things, even though I'm guilty of shutting down things myself sometimes. I'd also like to eventually argue for thinking about STEAM instead of STEM, of incorporating arts inside a science, technology, engineering, and math curriculum. And I guess ending this talk with a call for more thematic interdisciplinary research. And as you notice, I didn't change the slide, but this references the tensions around those three terms, inter, multi, and transdisciplinary. And a call for cross-institutional partnerships. Wouldn't it be great if one day UB, Ateneo, La Salle, Miriam, state universities, we could all work jointly in a research project together? Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't it be great if we could have a joint a class that's team taught by someone from UP, from Ateneo, from Miriam, from La Salle? And then you have four different kinds of classes taught by four different profs from different universities. Wouldn't that be great? Because we all have something to give and we're running out of time. Mejo, I always like to think with this apocalyptic view in mind, because I think it, we need a there is a sense of urgency that we need to work with. Thank you.